Cito.
No.
Younger ones can.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
Yes, we are on the air. 90.7 FM. WGXC, let me do the first, very first station ID. You are tuned to WGXC 90.7, servicing Accra, Catskill, and Hudson, Columbia, and Greene County. Woo! Thank you for the show.
Saturday, May 1st, tune in the 8th annual Reveille broadcast on WGXC. It's 25 hours following the sunrise around the earth and listening to the dawn chorus at places throughout the world. The broadcast starts at midnight Eastern time, starting in London, heading across the Atlantic and picking up sounds from Wave Farm in the 5 a.m. hour. Then you hear daybreak across the United States, across the Pacific Ocean, into Asia, Africa, Europe, and back in London at midnight. Tune in all day, May 1st, from midnight to midnight, to Reveille on the radio at wgxc.org and go to soundtent.org for more information about this broadcast.
Wave Farm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Karen Werner of Montague, Massachusetts. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Are you tired of your flying saucer always breaking down on your way to Mars?
Wish you could get more bang for your whoopee at the gas pump?
Well, here at Flying Saucer Mart, we have the perfect flying saucer for you.
It goes as fast as light. It comes in a variety of colors and only costs you 75 whoopee.
Come down to 375 Bionic Ave in Pluto City and fly home with a new used flying saucer today.
You are listening to Transmission Arts Programming on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Welcome back to another episode of Wave Pharmacy on WGXC 90.7 FM. I am one half of your hosts. My name is Jen Cutler. I'm here with Tim Light. Say hi.
Hey.
All right. And we have a very special guest here with us today, Marlene Altman Cutler, who also happens to be my mother. She is a social worker of how many years now?
Since 1991, I've been working in the field.
That's amazing. We're going to work with Marlene, who is a mental health expert, to solve technical problems using mental health techniques. So why don't we start? Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and your experience?
Okay, well, hi, and thank you for having me on your show. And as I started to say, I've been working in the field of mental health since 1991. Most of my work has been in a hospital, doing social work in drug rehabs as well as outpatient treatment programs. The majority of my patients have mental illness in addition to substance use issues. And I also spent some time working at Rikers Island.
Wow, great. And do you have any teaching experience?
I do. I teach at a local college in their addiction studies program. I've been doing that for quite a while now.
Wow. That's impressive. What are your credentials?
I'm a licensed clinical social worker and credentialed alcoholism and substance abuse counselor, as well as I also have the international credentials so that I can do addiction counseling internationally.
Oh, wow. That's very impressive. So can you tell us a little bit about your day-to-day in the field, like what kind of work you find yourself doing?
I'm recently retired from my hospital work in a drug rehab. I was there for almost 15 years, and I worked with patients there who had already been stabilized from withdrawal symptoms, and if they needed psychotropic medication, stabilized on medication, and did drug treatment for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks in some cases. They lived in the hospital, and we worked with them around the clock. And I'm still teaching at a college in the addiction studies program. Most of my students are adults who are going for their credential for addiction counseling. Some of my students are social workers who are there to re-credential for their social work degree.
Okay. So tell us, what's your experience with technology and engineering?
Basically, I'm a dinosaur. I do enough to get by and prize myself whenever I can do something. But if it wasn't for the help that I've gotten, I probably would be talking into a cassette deck right now.
All right. First program.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with cassette. You know.
Yes.
Except for the pencil situation. All right. Well, should we jump right in?
Let's jump right in.
All right. So the first question we have is, why do I need to keep resetting my router?
Oh no. Why do I need to keep resetting my router? There's a bazillion reasons of why you need to keep resetting your router. What are you doing to your router?
Well, I think that it's important that we all stay connected in one way or another. And especially now in the times of the pandemic, staying connected in an intimate and
this is amazing.
Real way is very important, and resetting your router will help you to keep that consistent connection.
Any thoughts about why it stops functioning?
Well, sometimes it wants to stop functioning. Sometimes it may need a break. Also, you know, we all have limitations. And I think that our technology may have limitations as well. So resetting the router helps to keep things clear and consistent.
I'm saying it.
Yeah, I'll take it. Okay, all right. Here's one.
Packet overflow.
Yeah, packet overflow. Seriously.
Your silence makes for great radio.
Well, it seems like you've just been overwhelmed with mail there that you're sorting through.
Packet overflow.
Have a great, great following.
We have so many listeners who send us these amazing messages.
Yeah,
if you would like to join them, you can email us at wavepharmacy@gmail.com and we'll read your question on the radio for one of our experts, whether it be technical or emotional. So that's wavepharmacy@gmail.com.
Yeah, I mean, it's my understanding Google had to spin up an additional server just to handle the number of letters that come into the pharmacy.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, the carbon footprint is incredible.
I'm planting trees every day.
Yeah.
Just to try to offset it.
So,
I don't believe the number of times I had to reset my router.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We do it all the time. It's like...
like eating or brushing your teeth.
Yeah. Changing your underwear. Reset the router.
Yep.
Okay. So this one says, I'm having trouble telling if my emails are spam. Can you help me figure out which emails are spam and which aren't?
Well, I think that that's a really good question and very important. You know, growing up in today's world, it's easy to have trust issues. And when it comes to spam, they get you where you live. So not knowing and knowing that you don't know is the first step towards being able to move past that. In addition to spam, I would watch going fishing may be a problem as well.
For fear of drowning? I don't follow.
For
like
fear
a fishing
of,
scam?
Fishing scammers, yeah.
So yes. So don't go biting.
Fishing information, right. Don't go biting, okay.
We've been trying to contact you about your extended car warranty.
No.
Your social security number is expired. We only accept Visa gift cards.
Oh, terrific.
I think that, you know, what we're up against is really ageism. And that many people who haven't grown up with the internet and with emails become victims to this kind of scamming. And it's basically because we live in a society where older people aren't respected as well as they are in other cultures and aren't cared for as well as they may be in other cultures. So I think that the problem with not knowing how to detect scam is just, you know, another aspect of the kind of world that we live in and how we need to look at ourselves and look at each other a little differently. And the fact that there's so much fear about people's privacy being violated and no ethic about in our culture about respecting people's privacy and boundaries. So all of this gets played out when you try to open your mail and immediately worry about what you're receiving and how you can protect yourself.
Well, the ageism piece is really interesting. I wonder, though, from what you're saying, is that we have to... What I hear you saying is that we have to consider ethics around privacy and spamming. So are you saying that professional criminals who make their money scamming people should consider being more empathetic? Is that what we're saying?
Well, I think that what we need to do is to learn how to protect our people. And if we know that people are having difficulty, instead of rewarding the scammers by allowing them to rip people off and get away with it and make a lot of money and gain respect based on the amount of money that they have, we need to look at instead how we can protect people from scammers and not reward people who are gaining money and gaining attention and gaining power in ways that aren't appropriate.
So, you know what's really interesting about this is that I think it's not quite as cut and dry as you're suggesting it is. I've actually guilted a scammer. This is my personal experience. And there was a line at which they stopped trying to scam me. So I got a call. It was about, you know, increasing your health coverage or something. I knew immediately that it was spam. But I pressed one. I was like, let's do this. I was connected to somebody who was probably in Bangladesh. And we started talking. And I was like, hey, look. I live in the United States. I don't have health insurance. I have cancer. And I can't afford treatment. I really, really need help with my health insurance. Can you help me? And at first, he was like, oh, yeah, no problem. You know, let me just get some details from you, da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, oh, thank you so much, you know, because the healthcare system in this country is so screwed up. Like, this is a pre-existing condition, so it's really hard for me to get covered. And I just kind of gave him this crazy sob story. And he was like, wait. He was like, you have cancer and you don't have insurance? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, oh. He was like, yeah, I can't help you. Good luck, though. Have a good day. So I think that this is not as cut and dry as you think it is, but I think it also has to do with how people perceive the other, right?
I think that at the end of the day, you know, we have to be able to live with ourselves. And stealing from someone, no matter how you justify it, is still stealing. And it's at best a band-aid to the problem. A band-aid that will really hurt when you rip it off and not really provide a whole lot of healing to the situation.
Do you believe that that's also true for corporations?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think Robin Hood was wrong?
I think that Robin Hood, in his time, did the best that he could with what he had. I think that today our challenges are much more significant in that we're living it. We're dealing with it today. We're not looking back at history. And how we move forward is going to be essential. So it boils down to the age-old question of do the ends justify the means? And I think that looking at my own actions and holding myself accountable to be the best person I can be is the better way to go. It's interesting because as a social worker, when I went to school way back when, I was trained to be an agent of social change. That's what how my school defines social work. And I spent a lot of my years trying to not just work with individuals to help them better their own situations, but also look at systems and how systems could be changed to make a better situation. I think the way to bring about peace in the world is to find a way to have peace in myself first. And if I know how to have peace in myself and can help other people find peace in their self, then little by slowly it will spread and the world will be more peaceful.
I was going to say, do you have peer-reviewed research to back that up?
No.
Don't check your email.
Okay. Here's one. Why is my phone draining so fast?
Oh no. You're using it too much.
So, do we have any background information about the problem?
It's an Android.
Okay. And we don't know how old the Android is.
We don't know.
Okay. Or how it's being cared for.
We don't know.
Yeah.
In the pool.
Yeah. Someone went swimming with it.
So, I think that all of those things are things to consider, you know, it's easy for things to get run down and lose energy and need recharging. And, I think a lot of it depends on the care and also the environment, what kind of connection the environment has.
Huh. Yeah, I think age is a big factor, too. You know, batteries are not meant to last forever.
Maybe carbon-based?
Lithium-ion polymer, probably.
Mm-hmm. Is it a flip phone?
I don't think so. I think it's a smartphone.
Okay.
Here's what I can tell you. If you accidentally pierce the membrane that encloses the battery, it will blow up.
Yeah.
Violently.
Yeah, it's terrible.
High piercing.
Yeah. So if you change it yourself, don't use sharp, pointy tools to get it out.
How does it feel about being tattooed?
It would blow up.
Just
I don't know how it would feel, but what it would do is it would blow up.
Wow.
It's a very sensitive membrane. Maybe like the blood-brain barrier, so to speak. Though it's not really responsible for internal logic or processing. Although I imagine those won't really like to be hit with pointy objects either. Are you sympathetically listening?
I am. I'm also thinking that, you know, unless it gets rebuilt, it can't really continue to give. So, how much is it being used, and how is it being treated when it's in operation? Making sure that it has ample time to recharge. Mm-hmm.
Well, Tim, you know a lot about this topic, don't you? I feel like we've had a lot of conversations where we're discussing the saltwater battery.
Oh, well, yeah, there is an ion exchange going on, so.
And we were talking a little bit about the difference between deep cycle batteries and, like, car batteries. What is
to kind of give you a superficial get up and go, and it's kind of up to the alternator and the rest of the mechanics to keep you going.
What makes a deep cycle battery able to provide more than that?
Oh, yeah. What do you think I am, a chemist?
Yeah. Well, we did. We talked about it. There were like rods, right? There was metal.
I mean, yeah, it's just the physical construction of the battery, but, you know, there are certain properties in there.
there that I don't know of at this time because you're putting me on the spot, but...
you build the battery a little bit differently in a formal way.
But they're not really super flexible in their application. You have a deep cycle battery, it'll be a deep cycle battery for its entire life. Whereas a car starting battery will be a car starting battery for its entire life. Although they are kind of based on the same principle and have similar chemistries, they're not really the same thing.
Okay. Well, a quick Google search.
Quick Google search.
Has explained to me that I'm wrong. They're not lithium polymer.
Really?
They're lithium ion.
Ah.
Which means you can't mail them, because guess what? If you poke a hole at them, they blow up. So they can't. They can only be transported on the ground. You can't transport them in the air. But it says that mobile phone batteries are supposed to retain 80% of their charge capacity after 300 to 500 charge-discharge cycles, with most battery degradation occurring during deep discharge-charge cycles. It's actually better to limit the battery discharge during any one cycle before charging it again.
Oh, no kidding.
And I've heard this. If you let your... It's like your car battery. If you let your car battery die, then that's... You basically have to start looking at getting another car battery because it's going to have a limited life after that. Mm-hmm. But if you don't let it die, it will live a lot longer. And this goes back to that conversation of deep cycle versus regular car battery. But it appears to be true generally for all batteries. What?
That's very interesting.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I learned.
Well, I think it's not unlike people that if you pace yourself and don't allow yourself to get burnt out, the chances are you're over time, you'll last a lot longer.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's... There's something about that, like, you know when you've been up for, like, 48 hours, and then you sleep for, like, 12 hours, and you wake up and you still feel tired?
Yes.
That's an example.
Take frequent water breaks.
For you or the battery?
Both.
So we're back to the pool.
We are, yeah. It's just a circle of life. It's the hydrological cycle.
Yes. Mostly logical. all right.
So, is what you're talking about also apply to lithium batteries?
That's what we were talking about, lithium ion batteries.
Oh, okay.
What?
Polymer.
Oh, yeah, no, not lithium polymer, lithium ion.
Yeah, okay.
Do you think that the lithium batteries are more evened out than, say, lead-acid batteries? Do you think that lead-acid batteries might, I don't know, see things or hear things that aren't there?
Yeah, well, you know, acid is like that.
And lithium?
Lithium is supposed to be a natural stabilizing element.
Is it natural?
You have to be careful with what the level is of lithium.
Yeah, I imagine battery manufacturers say that. Especially since it's an ion.
Yeah.
In this case. All right. Acid jokes with my mom. oh boy. Oh, here's a good one. Why is my internet connection so slow?
Didn't we talk about this in the beginning? When was the last time you restarted your router and recharged your batteries?
Alternately, you know, is Verizon your service provider?
Right. When did you, last time you recharged your router, restarted your batteries?
Right. Yeah. It's all connected, all related.
It's a series of tubes, and if the tubes are too full.
What?
That look you just gave me.
No, I don't understand what you said.
A series of tubes? You never heard of the internet being referred to as a series of tubes?
I've never heard that.
Neither have I.
It's a series of tubes.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't know. Some congressman, I think, referred to it like that and was trying to explain why high-speed internet was not accessible across the entire country. The tubes are too congested or something to this effect.
That's hilarious because it's literally the opposite of a tube.
Yep.
It's a cylinder. It's a like a spider network of cylinders.
Correct.
Even regardless if it's copper or fiber.
Mm-hmm.
Or God forbid, phone line.
So why is my internet so slow?
Why is my internet so slow?
Too much noise.
So is slow it, compared to what? It's all relative.
Are you saying that? I'm moving too fast, and that's why the internet appears to be so slow?
Could be. That could be.
I'll start explaining that to my clients.
Or are the expectations too high? Maybe the internet's performing just fine.
Okay. But what about dollars you're paying for the internet, right? Like, say you bought the package, the fancy package that costs kind of a lot of money. That's like 100 megabits per second up and 100 megabits per second down. And then you get on there and you're like, you know, the pictures are loading like 56K. Like, you get the stripes going across the screen.
Scammed again.
Scammed. But legally, in this case.
Scam is a scam.
There's a lot to unpack here. There's a lot to unpack. I mean, you could have trouble anywhere in your network, not necessarily with your internet connection itself.
Yeah, as tempted as I am to call the cops on my internet service provider.
Are your tubes clear, Jen?
I thought you were talking about, like, you know, like, the predecessor of the transistor.
No, I was thinking, like, you know, a pipe.
Yeah, no.
A tunnel. Like, a tunnel for bits.
And then I imagined if there was a server that ran on tube technology.
Yeah, it was called the ENIAC.
The ENIAC. Did it record its data to tape?
Probably.
It sounds difficult to use.
It was awesome.
Was it a mainframe?
It was pre-mainframe.
Did you have to use punch cards with it?
I think it may have been pre-punch card.
What did you do with it?
I think you might have programmed it with a keyboard.
A musical keyboard?
A teletype. Or even you may have been even entering register values in binary one at a time.
Sometimes it feels like that's what communicating with other people is like, and the computer is actually really easy to deal with.
I feel personally attacked right now.
Do you often feel that way too?
Oh no, now we've turned this into a therapy session.
This is all going down now.
I'm not paying for it. Why is your internet so slow?
Because you're just moving too damn fast.
But what if your computer is only like a 386 with a token ring network card in it?
a token ring?
Yeah, so, you know, you got 100 up and 100 down, but if your computer can't go faster than, you know, 56K.
Yeah, I guess you have to kind of figure out where the bottleneck really is. But I think that's true in life. You have to, you know, you could be like, I never have clean clothes. Why do I never have clean clothes? And you'd be like, well, clearly...
I don't know how to use the laundry machine.
Yeah, I bought the washer dryer. Why are all my clothes clean?
No, you didn't read the manual.
That's...
got some reading to do. That's the best part of the washer and dryer.
Is the manual.
Well, maybe the diagram inside of it. The manual is, you know, stuff.
Uh-huh. All right. Let's see what we've got. Oh, it's going down.
Oh, no. I can't tell if she's found another question or if she's in a Facebook fight with like a white supremacist or something.
I don't know. She's covering her nose.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm replacing the keyboard on my Irish Dell Inspiron 7537, but nice. It's very expensive. A French one is available. I can deal with the layout change, which has the same number of keys and fits, etc., but will it work?
I'm thinking this is a trick question.
Well, it's a laptop.
For the same model laptop?
And what is behind the change? Why is this person making the change?
They don't specify.
Yeah, it would be great if we could get them, you know, in a dialogue.
It would.
One of my initial reactions, don't be prejudiced. Just change your keyboards, whatever works for you. Here's if it's French or English.
Well, they want to know if it will work.
Oh.
Well, time will tell.
Oh. Well, is it worth...
But it depends on what your needs are as well. And so why you wanted to make the change is important.
Well, they don't specify why they want to make the change. They just want to know if it's going to.
Don't we all want to know that?
Well, you know, the question I think is, should he take the plunge?
Yes.
See, and I'm a firm believer in, if it's not broken, don't fix it.
There's some friction. What?
You might want to know, what about innovation? But if this person wants to change what they're using, there must be some dissatisfaction or desire to improve something in making the change. And so whatever that issue is, I think it's important to identify it so that then you know what you're looking at if you're trying to determine if it's going to work or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tim, you're the Windows expert here.
Oh, throwing me under the bus again.
Okay, so I generally use OS X. Not necessarily Mac, but OS X.
Yeah.
And in OS X, there's a very easy way to be able to change between country keyboards from the operating system.
Mm-hmm.
Does that exist in Windows?
It sure does.
So why doesn't he just do that?
I think this person is fine. This is I'm approaching these issues from a way too technical standpoint.
I mean, this may be a fickle person.
This is going to work just fine.
Whoa, that's a bold accusation.
Yeah, it's true. I'm pretty sure I did the same thing on my computer. I had to replace my keyboard. So my keyboard broke.
What happened?
I think I spilled some iced tea on it.
It didn't like that?
It did not. Don't feed laptop computers iced tea.
Is that your Lenovo?
It is.
Okay.
Was it hard? No, it was easy. Now it has a Hebrew keyboard on it.
Oh, yeah. I remember that Hebrew keyboard.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
The computer doesn't really care. It's going to see the same bitch dream coming in.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. In OS X, they make you type the key that's on either on the right of the shift key and on the left of the other shift key so that it can determine on its own what your keyboard layout is. Which is really frustrating when you connect like an audio interface, it thinks it's a keyboard and...
Oh, good times.
We have fun here.
Yes. It reminds me I'm going to buy a nice... I'm going to buy myself a nice keyboard.
Are you going to get one of the crazy ones that click?
Yes. Yes. Can I? Yes, I am. The buckling spring keyboard is there.
Okay. Here's another question. This is an audio question. This comes from a mixing engineer. And they write, which room would be better for mixing? I have a lot of treatment, and I'm going to adhere to the 38% rule. I'm not aware of what the 38% rule is, but I probably shouldn't. I need to choose one of these rooms before I start installing everything. Thanks for your help. There's a 14 by 11 and 21 by 7 feet. So, what do we think, everyone?
What kind of treatment?
Substance abuse treatment?
That's what I was wondering. What kind of treatment? Acoustic? Substance abuse?
Yeah, it's acoustic. Acoustic treatment for mixing.
What are you mixing?
Audio.
That clarifies it.
It doesn't. The rules don't change based on what genre you're mixing. I don't think.
It doesn't.
No, but I did just Google the 38% rule.
What's that?
Let's
see. Only accept 38% of paying gigs. Why would it not? If I was recording myself and I was in my house, I could do it in this tiny little room. But if I was recording the New York Philharmonic with a 275-channel console, I would need a room bigger than this one.
Okay, you're talking about recording. This guy's talking about mixing.
Oh, mixing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
this is what happens when you ask non-experts questions.
That's why Marlene is here. So Marlene's going to clear it up for all of us.
Yeah, good point.
Here I go.
Okay.
So I think that first, the fact that this person wants to mix is a very good sign.
Oh, good.
And is concerned about doing it in a way that isn't going to create any problems, I think is another positive.
Yeah, this sounds like a great person.
Yeah.
I would definitely send their Nigerian prince cousin $40,000.
So, whether they like to do it in a small area or in a big area has to do with, you know, the quality of the sound and the experience, the kind of experience they're looking for.
Sure. I'm just going to figure out, because I don't think that 154, I want to look at the square footage and see what the difference is.
Uh-huh. What's the 38%?
Oh, yeah, we should discuss that, too. So, yeah, no, they're within 10 square feet of the size of each other. So they're comparable in the amount of space. It's the dimensions, I think, that he's concerned about. And I know the answer to this, but I'm not trying to come at this from a... Oh, you know what? Maybe I can work it together. Okay. The 38% rule. It's not a rule, but a guideline created by world-class studio designer Wes Lischow. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It's a theoretical optimum listening position in rectangular rooms, assumed ideal soundproofing, and flush or soffit-mounted speakers. Take it with a grain of salt. Like most rules of thumb, it's based on compromise, but you can use it as a starting point for your room setup. Later, you can use acoustic measurements to fine-tune everything. Really wishing that I read this before I set up my studio, but let's continue. Calculate 38% of your room's length and put a mark 38% back from the front wall, centered width-wise between the left and right sidewalls. This is the first spot I recommend you try as a listening position. As an alternative, you can place the listening position 38% from the rear wall, but it's better to be closer to the front wall. Bass peaks and nulls are worse further back due to strong reflections happening at the rear of your room. Absolutely avoid sitting right against your back wall. That's the worst position for comb filtering, unless you have the wall behind you treated with massively thick absorption. Also, if you plan to use diffusion on your rear wall, you're going to need some space behind you for the scattered sound waves to disperse.
So positioning is, in fact, very subjective.
It's subjective, but it's specific to your space. So what we're talking about, especially in a rectangular room, which is the least ideal type of room you can have for mixing, I can't help myself. I'm just going to keep talking about this because it's something that I care about. Oh, God. When you have parallel surfaces in a room, what happens is the sound will bounce from one surface to the other surface and back and forth and so on. So what they said, combing can occur at certain frequencies depending on the distance and where the speakers are placed. You know, bass can build up in certain locations through the corners. And as you walk around the room, the frequency response of the sound will actually be very significantly different, so much so that if you mix from one position and then listen 2 feet to the side, it'll sound completely different. I bet you're not thinking about that when you listen to Kevin Obama. So anyway.
I'm not thinking about positions too much.
That's a relief. All right. So
it really has to do with the desired effect that you want. If how you position the mixing makes such a difference in the sound.
Wait, say that again?
Taking it into consideration is part of, you know, the artist's style.
Well, there is an art to this, don't get me wrong, but it's mostly utilitarian, in my opinion. And that's probably just because I record so poorly. There are tasks you have to complete in order to make sure that everything is audible and sits where it needs to sit, so to speak, in the mix. There are artistic things that you can do. But, you know, this is a form of engineering. Sound engineering is a form of engineering. An electrical engineer will laugh and say, no, that's not true. Biomedical engineer will laugh and say, no, that's not true. But there are technical aspects to this. I'm sorry, I feel like I'm shutting you down. I don't mean to shut you down.
Well, that fine line between personal style and technique and the outcome of the overall performance. You know, that's something that is not so easy to find balance with.
Oh, not at all. I mean, most people would hire a professional. If they were really professional mixing engineers and they were building a professional mixing studio, they would hire an acoustician to come in, you know, and to take measurements.
But then they would miss the thrill of it all.
Yes, that is what they would miss. Do you see this creature?
No, we're on the radio.
She really likes that rug.
Here's a small dog named Scout.
Have you taught her how to sing?
Yeah, no. Maybe. Did you hear that?
Disagrees.
That was a great thing you did. Okay, sorry, back to the mixing treatment. Can I pipe in with an obligatory golden ratio comment?
Yes.
There are mathematical reasons for, or not reasons, but explanations for why rooms feel a certain way as a human being, right? You ever walk down a hallway and think, wow, this is a really narrow hallway, or wow, this is a really wide hallway, or wow, the ceilings are really high in this hallway. What makes it feel wide or high or long? There's actually a ratio that describes that. It's more or less the human perception of what makes us feel comfortable spatially, among many other things. And that's called the golden ratio. But my inclination would be to use a 14 by 11 room. Because it's closer to the golden ratio. And it will feel more comfortable. When you have a long room, reflections are gonna be harder to deal with because those two parallel walls are gonna be elongated. I think that there's more room in a 14 by 11 room for you to be able to put, you know, not just your studio equipment, but you can put like a couch or studio furniture, which will also be some. Who wants to sit in a 21 by 7 room? It seems, it would feel weird. You would feel like you're in a long room. Said from her very strangely shaped studio.
Yeah, we've really struck a nerve with this one.
Yeah, sorry. I can't help myself. It's like impedance matching. Once it starts, I just...
She can't help herself.
I can't be helped. So, what do you think? Does the golden ratio ever come up in your work, Marlene?
The golden ratio. Well, I've heard that as a euphemism for different things, but no, it actually hasn't.
Well, remember, we're before 10 p.m., and there are FCC guidelines about what you can and cannot say on the radio, so just bear that in mind, Mom.
Okay. Well, I think your explanation really was a good one.
Oh, great. Should we have one last technical problem before
Yeah, I think we have time for one more.
One more. Does anybody have any real technical emergencies that need to be dealt with? Scout?
Not anything pressing that we haven't already covered in today's episode.
Okay. No burning desires.
It's a family disease. Why is my car smoking from under the hood?
smoking has become such an issue, and better smoking under the hood than over the hood.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. This really reminds me of this guy I used to know. He did a little too much acid, and he never really came back. He had a car, and when he would turn it on, black smoke would start bellowing out from under the hood. We'd be like, "Hey George, what's going on with your car, man?" And he'd be like, "What do you mean?" I don't know how he drove that thing. He probably couldn't see out the windshield. I guess that didn't really stop him. What do we think? How's our mechanic knowledge? Our emotional support mechanic?
Well, the first thing to do is to put out the fire.
Interesting. How would you go about doing that?
Doing an immediate crisis intervention to determine whether there's smoke, there's fire. What's the cause of all that smoke and putting it out? And then after things have quieted down, to do a little exploring about what was going on that contributed to that crisis.
Well, what would you do exactly to put the fire out, though?
Well, the first thing I would do is unplug everything.
From the car.
And turn off the engine. Make sure the engine is off.
Okay.
Then gradually, slowly, carefully lifting the hood and looking at surveying the situation.
What if it's too painful?
Sorry?
What if it's too painful? The hood is very hot.
The hood is very hot. Then we have to just breathe. Make sure that we're breathing air that isn't full of smoke.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's pretty smoky.
and you know, using breath to calm ourselves.
It smells like burning rubber. Does it matter if the smoke is black or white? Or blue?
I think it probably does matter, but not immediately. The first thing is just to put it out, to turn everything off and allow it to, air out a bit. Getting some support would be really important, especially if you don't have anybody there who can help you.
So like AAA?
These days, most people have cell phones. It's easy enough to, call for support and make sure that you use discretion in who you choose to call.
So like a AAA mobile crisis hotline.
Might be just the thing.
So
not everybody has access to that. But
so basically Wade Pharmacy.
Right, there you go.
Got it.
Yeah, perfect.
If you need somebody to make fun of your very serious car or mental health problems, you know where to go.
It's important not to take ourselves too seriously.
I'm glad you feel that way.
But having assistance and having people to reach out to is really important.
Yeah.
Fires can be treacherous, but you can also learn a lot from them.
Yeah. Never underestimate the raw power of a mental health professional.